To rehearse a dialectical truism, theory is a form of practice. In their local interplay, as in that between metropole and colony, theory and practice condition one another. Each case is different. Thus, it is not enough simply to classify Israel as settler colonial on the basis of its manifest instantiation of the logic of elimination. We also need to trace the distinctive ways in which this logic acquired life and form through practical hostilities conducted between invaders and natives on the colonial ground in Palestine. Settler colonialism's essential feature, its sustained institutional tendency to supplant the indigenous population, reconciles a range of historical practices that might otherwise seem distinct. It is important to stress his multiplicity because the techniques of dispossession whereby settlers supplanted the natives of Palestine differ significantly from the kindred sets of practices whereby settlers dispossessed the natives of Australia and of North America. Nonetheless, the eliminatory outcome has remained constant, so the situation provides an opportunity to explore settler colonialism's strategic versatility. To explain a settler colonial invasion, it can never be enough simply to invoke the global potency of capital, mighty though that is. Rather, in each case, settler ascendancy rests on a particular contextual mobilization of Europe's pre-accumulated colonial resources. We need to go behind the frontier to the historical preconditions that equipped the invaders for settlement before they set foot in native country. Two major differences have held out as distinguishing the Zionist acquisition of Palestine from the settler colonizations of Australia and of the USA. In the first instance, Zionism originated as an international movement that consciously avoided confinement to a single metropolis in favor of a supportive transnational umbrella that Rodinson termed the, quote, collective mother country, unquote. Second, prior to the end of 1947, Zionism was conspicuous for its policy of purchasing native land in at least notional conformity with the domestic laws of the current local power. In these two important respects, Zionist policy in Palestine differed strikingly from settler policies in Australia or the United States. On examination, however, Zionist policy in Palestine constitutes an intensification of, rather than a departure from, earlier settler colonial models. In stark contrast to the Australian or U.S. cases, for instance, Zionism rigorously refused, as it continues to refuse, any suggestion of native assimilation. In this and other ways that will be discussed below, Zionism constitutes a more exclusive exercise of the settler logic of elimination than we encounter in the Australian and U.S. examples. This conclusion only seems surprising if one concentrates on features that are extraneous to the indigenous experience, as Zionist apologists understandably do. By way of correction, we will examine these two features that have frequently been cited as distinguishing Zionism from settler colonialism: the lack of a unitary metropole and the policy of purchase, not in isolation, but in the wider historical context within they were strategically conjoined. As will emerge, the two constitute integrated aspects of a uniquely developed program of indigenous dispossession. The basic link between Zionism's diffuse metropole and Jewish land purchases in Palestine consists in the fact that the former financed the latter. As we saw earlier, the frontier was led from behind, typically by speculators. Speculators, moreover, who tended not to be limited by nationality. So far as the creation of transnational networks for exporting metropolitan capital in order to place and maintain settlers in Palestine is concerned, therefore, there is nothing exceptional about Zionism. Rather, Zionism's peculiarity concerns the distinctive quality of the capital involved. This, in turn, reflects the fact that, in the case of Palestine, the natives were already incorporated into, and to that extent protected by, extensive, albeit moribund, colonial empires, first Ottoman, then British, a factor that encouraged settler conformity to domestic property law. In this context, the resources that Zionism was able to coordinate distinguish the capital transmitted to Palestine from the general run of speculative investment whereby capital was exported to other European colonies. With the possible and early exception of Baron Rothschild, the capital that Zionists garnered for investment in Palestine, as Barbara Smith has pointed out, was not conditional on the return of a financial profit. In this crucial regard, donors who funded the World Zionist Project differed from the speculators who had financed territorial expansion in Australia and North America. Unencumbered by the requirement to return a profit, subsidized Zionist settlers enjoyed the easiest of imported advantages in relation to the local population, a confounding of capitalist rationality that overwhelmed the finite native stock. For a sustained colonizing program that was to achieve such enormous successes, the Zionist plan for Palestine displays a consistent set of features whose effectiveness has not been hampered by its remarkable simplicity. Ostensibly operating within established imperial frameworks, but always with an eye to eventually supplanting them, Zionists have secured international support, both from regnant imperial powers and from private sources, for two overriding purposes: to convert an ever-expanding contiguous wedge of Palestine from native ownership into an irreversibly Jewish endowment, and to procure the import from overseas of funding and Jewish personnel at a level sufficient to maintain the continued expansion of this ethnocratically consolidated zone by whatever means should prove available and viable. This strikingly simple plan has been pursued with a sleepless organizational tenacity that remains apparent in Israel's ongoing disinclination to specify its borders.